Good morning. Welcome to the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. I'm Eric Hepburn. I'm your lay leader this morning. We are an intentionally inclusive congregation, and we welcome persons of all religions, ages, sexual orientations, ethnic and racial origins, socioeconomic conditions, political convictions, abilities, and other circumstances. We extend a special welcome to those of you who are guests with us today. I'd like to open this morning with a few quotes from the Greg Mortensen book, Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission to Promote Peace, One School at a Time. This book has been selected as this summer's social action reading for our congregation, and I hope that these brief quotes will invite you to find out more. When you take the time to actually listen, with humility, to what people have to say, it's amazing what you can learn. Especially if the people who are doing the talking also happen to be children. You have to attack the source of your enemy's strength. In America's case, that's not Osama or Saddam or anyone else. The enemy is ignorance. It's so easy to believe that those with whom we disagree don't have anything to teach us, when wisdom teaches us that quite the opposite is always true. The people with whom we disagree have the most to teach us.
Let us pray or meditate, as your interest indicate. And when you pray, you shall not be as the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and in the corners of the streets, that they may be seen of men. Verily I say unto you, they have received their reward. But you, when you pray, enter into your inner chamber, and having shut your door, pray to your Father who is in secret. Your Father, who sees in secret, will recompense you. Reading today, it is from Khalil Gibran's The Prophet, and the section is on children. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you, for life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. You are the bows from which your children, as living arrows, are sent forth. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite, and he bends you with his might, that his arrows may go swift and far. Let your bending in the arrow's hand be for gladness, for even as he loves the arrow that flies, so he loves the bow that is stable. What do fundamentalists know about religion that Unitarians have forgotten and need to relearn? With deference to the soon-to-be-departing Ron Paris, I want to start this with a confession. The title is a bit deceptive. When I first gave the sermon, I tended to use the term fundamentalist as a synonym for evangelical, as many people still do. Today, I wouldn't use that fundamentalist to mean evangelical, or conservative, or traditional. And those are really the religious groups that I want to talk about. Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and the Saudi Arabian government are fundamentalist, as are Pat Robertson, various recent presidents of the Southern Baptist Convention, and a host of others who have done such outrageous things as praise terrorist attacks on Americans, plot political takeovers during church services, foment the murder of abortion providers, spit on mourners at funerals for fallen soldiers, and advocate revolutionary violence against the United States. They are a recent phenomenon, a cancer on most major world religions, an attack on all modern thought and values. They are fascists who masquerade using traditional religious language. In contrast, the denomination I was born in, the Southern Baptist before 1979, denomination was by basic principle apolitical. Members tended to be politically conservative, but people like Jimmy Carter, Bill Moyers, and my parents had no trouble fitting in. Why should we be interested in this or other traditional groups? These are, after all, the traditions that many of us feel that we have outgrown. If anything, we think we have a bit to teach them. And perhaps we do. But demographics have not been kind to us in recent decades. We are grouped with liberal or mainline Protestant groups, which also include the Episcopal, Methodist, Lutheran, and Presbyterian churches. We share one problem today. None of these groups can convince our own children that what we do is worth preserving. UUs have mostly made up for these losses with adult conversions, so we have not quite joined the other groups' apparent race to extinction, but we are still in trouble. Politicians have taken notice, of course, and where in 1960 it was mainline Protestant voices that they used for moral cover, today it is usually conservative Catholics, evangelical Protestants, or Mormons, if not outright fundamentalists, that dominate the public forum. And it's not, as some seem to think, that these groups are especially successful at proselytizing our children, who mostly become unchurched as adults, and so far invisible as far as the political culture is concerned. But the conservatives, at least for the most part, are keeping their own children. For some groups, like the high birth rate Mormons, that would be enough for rapid growth. If these changes in American culture and politics bother us, and I think they should, we have lots of serious explaining to do. We think that we have a better approach to religious experience, but it is they who do the better job of convincing their own children that what they have is important. From the beginning, human beings have bonded into groups by all believing in the same six impossible things before breakfast. Once these groups started stepping on one another's toes by living together in cities or traveling to other villages and far places, religion began to be something different from the overall culture. This was the place where you met with your support group. You would still prefer to shut up those fools who disagreed, if you had the power to do so, but the religious group helped you to endure if you could not. Christianity, by the 4th century, had its own share of crazy ideas and also the power of the Roman state to shut up everybody who disagreed. Despite the fall of the Western Empire, the state of things persisted in Europe until a century of religious wars between Catholics and Protestants ended in the 17th century in a peace of exhaustion. Neither group had been quite able to exterminate the other. By the late 18th century, in places like the English colonies in America, toleration came to be seen as a virtue in itself. The idea was that different religious groups could scream at each other all that they liked, but had to leave the swords, battle axes, and torture chambers at home. Today, you use profess not to feel threatened by all these competing ideas, that our ideas are strong enough to survive out in the marketplace. Our advertising campaigns try to persuade the unchurched that they are very much like us. We are at one with the larger intellectual world, with science, human reason, and American moral values. But that works both ways. We are very much like them. Traditional religious groups feel more alienated from the overall world of ideas. Their beliefs are quite distinct from the larger world and from those of each other. There are small doctrinal differences seem to be very important. For us Baptists, which is what I was as a kid, we asserted our lack of creed but accused other Christians of getting the rite of baptism all wrong. We, like most traditional Christians, believe that salvation was by grace of God rather than by good deeds of human beings. But I and my Church of Christ cousins, little lawyers, all of us, went round and round on whether grace was enough or whether participation in the rite of baptism by the one true church, that was them, was also necessary. What, said I, if you are saved by grace on Monday, but die before you are safely baptized in church the following Sunday? I will spare you various other great ideas seminars we conducted. The point is, if the UU view of matters is pretty much the same as that of most of the secular world, why bother with church at all? Why not sleep in Sunday mornings, read a good book, go to a public lecture? If you are blessed to move in an academic environment or live in a cosmopolitan city of great cultural offerings, why do you need to attend a UU church at all? But if you're an evangelical, you will not get much reinforcement of six impossible beliefs except in your own church group. You will need to spend a lot of time there, perhaps attending every time the church doors are open. And at other times, you might even want to limit your socializing to other church members. Then there is moral behavior. For UUs, ethics is about helping others, helping the poor, the sick, the elderly, children, and other victims of social injustice. When we collect pennies for peace and try to build schools for girls in remote Asian villages, we are acting in the great ethical tradition. We have support in the teachings of Jesus, of the Hebrew prophets, of Muhammad, of Confucius, and of many other seminal religious teachers. But for evangelical religions, most of these things are not so much morals as they are political issues on which good Christians can differ. As a young Baptist, most of my time in church and Sunday school seemed to be spent in being warned against various gateway evils. Gambling was wrong because it led to playing cards. Promiscuous sex was wrong because it led to dancing, and smoking marijuana was wrong because it led to tobacco. Or maybe I have that backwards. I don't know. There were never any lessons on the evils of racial discrimination, poverty in the midst of wealth, unjust wars, the rape of the world's resources, or other environmental disasters. Religious morality was about individual perfection, about keeping the temple of your body pure for God. UU moral positions tend to integrate us into the larger society in which we operate. Evangelical Protestant positions tend to separate us into little self-absorbed clusters. And these all become more reasons to structure your life around other church members, people you can socialize with and not necessarily imperil your immortal soul. Traditional religions, to pick on somebody besides the Baptist for a moment, traditional religions require constant work on the part of their members. Orthodox Judaism has seemingly an endless list of requirements of diet, clothing, and other rituals. Jewish friends have tried to explain to me how the laws of kosher are perfectly sensible. It seems the bans on eating pork, shellfish, and mixing meat with dairy products were all put together by ancient nutritionists protecting people from trichinosis, oysters out of season. Does Hebrew use the same distinction in its months with and without ours? I don't know. And we all know about the grim truth of eating, about eating fast food bacon cheeseburgers. Stuff and nonsense, as they say. The lawgivers wanted people to have to think about their religion every single day, and even the most trivial actions, just as my Baptist morality was designed to remind me of who I was, not to do good. For Jews, the result was a tough faith that people preserved in even the most extreme circumstances for thousands of years of living in isolated ghettos surrounded by hostile societies. In fact, few things have ever threatened Jewish identity more than living in religiously tolerant America over the last generation or so, where their declining numbers are similar to those of liberal Protestants. A rabbi once told me he considered UUs the greatest threat to Jewish survival, as we gave shelter to couples in mixed Jewish-Christian marriages. In an old fable, the sun and the north wind bet on which is the most powerful. The north wind tries to blow off a traveler's cloak, but he only wraps it ever more tightly about himself. Then the sun comes out, warms the land, and the traveler removes the cloak voluntarily. Other religions have found other ways of making life tough for members. Devout Muslims have to stop what they're doing 5 times a day to humble themselves before God. The fasting month of Ramadan and the required ultimate pilgrimage to Mecca are also hard things. Mormons require 2 full years missionary work from every young member as a rite of passage into adulthood. I have seen firsthand how much more serious and religiously committed a person can become after that experience. And then there are the Amish, who make their religious beliefs central to everything they do in life. Let's not forget the early radical Protestants. Medieval hell might have been a terrible fate waiting after death, filled with every juicy torture and humiliation a fevered imagination could come up with. But at least Catholics could feel safe as long as they remained obedient to and in good standing with the Church. These Protestants took upon themselves the burden of finding the way to avoid hell, but never being quite sure they were right. They became puritanical, self-denying, hard-working people who, by all work and no play, and avoiding idle hands, the devil's own workshop, might hope to escape damnation. There was no room for compassion in this. If other people were mostly bound for eternal torture after death, any suffering they encountered in this life was trivial anyway. So it tended to generate a lot of excess wealth that came to be called capital and ultimately to our rich modern society. All this just as a trivial side effect. Children brought up in such hard faiths knew the seriousness and importance of what was going on and usually continued them. I haven't talked as if the theological content mattered much in the success or failure of these religions. Some doctrines obviously do matter a great deal. Hell tends to grab one's attention. For the imaginative child who has been exposed to it, and the anxieties can last a lifetime, even if he rejects the idea in his head. Heaven is more like an afterthought for most believers, whether it is supposed to be filled with souls singing hymns for eternity. You should all read Mark Twain's brilliant parody of heaven. Or it is supposed to be filled with 40 virgins. So I guess it doubles as a place for bad virgins to go to be punished. Anyway, all of this is just kind of a bonus to go along with the biggie, which is avoiding hell. Above all, successful religions demand the belief that there is something that is greater than us, something before which we must humble ourselves. Arrogance is the opposite of real religious sentiment, which is something to remember as you watch swaggering televangelists with obvious financial or political agendas, that we humble ourselves is more important than what we humble ourselves to. Our own traditions are mixed. Universalists supposedly thought God was too good to condemn humanity to hell, and Unitarians that humans were too good to be condemned. If I had to choose, given what I know, have observed of the overall goodness in human behavior, I hope the Universalists had it right. I started by asking what traditional religious groups know and what we can learn from them. Some lessons we can obviously do without. I cannot imagine you use wanting to declare war on science and reason. Nor would we want to limit our concept of morality to keeping our bodies healthy while ignoring the world's problems, even those of us who might acknowledge that purity is a noble yen and very restful every now and then. But I think we do need to make the practice of Unitarian Universalism more difficult if we want to survive. We need an integrity about our lives, a sense that we are the same people with the same values on weekdays as Sundays. We need to be in covenant with one another so that our disagreements may be resolved without injury to any, and so that members always feel that being here or being with other UUs is a safe place. We must give more. It's hard to believe your faith is important to you when your giving is so embarrassingly poor compared with conservative churches, or so low that they have crippled severely the mission of your church. I know how hard my Baptist parents struggled to tithe. That means 10% of gross income, if any of you are in doubt, in what were often very grim circumstances. I know how far from that standard our own household falls. But Jesus' words are still relevant. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Contribute to the church's mission and to charities and to just political causes that the church itself cannot involve itself in. Contribute money and time. If Muslims can stop to pray 5 times a day, and Orthodox Jews can expend the effort to keep kosher at every meal, can we UUs not require ourselves to do at least one thing every day that reminds us of who we are? And we must also make religion harder for our children. How we strive to keep them entertained. It would be unthinkable to require them to sit through a boring old church service, or so we believe. Nonsense. Most children will live up or down to consistent adult expectations. Consider family discussions of moral issues. The Pennies for Peace Project would be a perfect opportunity to talk about what the problems are and what Greg Mortensen is arguing in 3 Cups of Tea that we should do about these problems. The long-term feedback will come in part by what happens in rural Asia, but also by what part of you your children decide in adulthood is worth carrying forward. That, above all, is what you youths must learn once more about religion, or die.
We build on foundations we did not lay. We warm ourselves at fires we did not light. We sit in the shade of trees we did not plant. We drink from wells we did not dig. We profit from persons we did not know. We are ever bound in community. This is how it should be, as long as we remember to light, to dig, and to plant.
As parting words, please read with me our mission statement. At First UU Church, we gather in community to nourish souls, transform lives, and do justice.
This is a presentation of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, visit our website at www.austinuu.org.